Hello, Sun Sounds listeners. This is Michael Shannon, your volunteer reader. I'm going to read the major news articles from the Monday, July 28th, 2025 edition of Tucson's Arizona Daily Star. Before we begin with the headline articles, let's find out what kind of weather is in store for us. Today's weather mostly sunny, hot, highs to 108 degrees Fahrenheit, winds west-northwest at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight's forecast, some clouds this evening will give way to mainly clear skies overnight. Lows to 79 degrees Fahrenheit, winds southeast at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow's forecast predicts generally sunny, highs around 105 degrees Fahrenheit, southeast winds shifting to north-northwest at 10 to 15 miles an hour. We'll begin with the reading of the first article on the Arizona Daily Star front page titled, U.S.-EU Deal Sets 15% Tariff on Most. This article was written by Will Weissert of the Associated Press, Dateline Edinburgh, Scotland. The United States and the European Union agreed on a trade framework Sunday, setting a 15% tariff on most goods, staving off, at least for now, far higher imports on both sides that might have sent shockwaves through economies around the globe. The sweeping announcement came after President Donald Trump and European Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen met briefly at Trump's Turnberry Golf Course in Scotland. Their private sit-down culminated months of bargaining, with the White House deadline Friday nearing for imposing punishing tariffs on the EU's 27 member countries. It was a very interesting negotiation. I think it's going to be great for both parties, Trump said. The agreement, he said, was a good deal for everybody and a giant deal with lots of countries. Von der Leyen said the deal will bring stability and it will bring predictability. That's very important for our businesses on both sides of the Atlantic. As with other recent tariff agreements that Trump announced with countries including Japan and the United Kingdom, some major details are pending in this one. Trump said the EU agreed to buy some $750 billion worth of U.S. energy and invest $600 billion more than it already is in America, as well as make a major military equipment purchase. He said tariffs for automobiles and everything else will be a straight across tariff of 15% and meant that U.S. exporters have the opening up of all the European countries. Von der Leyen said the 15% tariffs were across the board all-inclusive and that indeed basically the European market is open. At a later news conference away from Turnberry, she said the $750 billion in additional U.S. energy purchases was over the next 3 years and would help ease the dependence on natural gas from Russia among the bloc's countries. When the European Union and the United States work together as partners, the benefits are tangible, von der Leyen said, noting that the agreement stabilized on a single 15% tariff rate for the vast majority of EU exports, including cars, semiconductors, and pharmaceuticals. 15% is a clear ceiling, she said. But von der Leyen also clarified that such a rate would apply to everything, saying that both sides agreed on zero-for-zero tariffs on a number of strategic products, like all aircraft and components parts, certain chemicals, certain generic drugs, semiconductor equipment, some agricultural products, natural resources, and critical raw materials. It is unclear if alcohol will be included in that list. And we will keep working to add more products to this list, she said, while also stressing that the framework means the figures we have just explained to the public, but, of course, details have to be sorted out. And that will happen over the next weeks. In the meantime, there will be work to do on other fronts. Von der Leyen had a mandate to negotiate because the European Commission handles trade for member countries. But the Commission should now present a deal to members and EU lawmakers who will ultimately decide whether or not to approve it. Before their meeting began, Trump pledged to change what he characterized as a very one-sided transaction, very unfair to the United States. I think both sides want to see fairness, the Republican president told reporters. Von der Leyen said the U.S. and EU combined have the world's largest trade volume, encompassing hundreds of millions of people and trillions of dollars, and added that Trump was known as a tough negotiator and dealmaker, but fair, Trump said. Trump spent months threatening most of the world with large tariffs in hopes of shrinking major U.S. trade deficits, with many key trading partners. More recently, he hinted that any deal with the EU would have to buy down a tariff rate of 30% that was set to take effect. But during his comments before the agreement was announced, the president was asked if he'd be willing to accept tariff rates lower than 15%, and he said no. Their meeting came after Trump played golf for the second straight day at Turnberry, this time with a group that also included sons Eric and Donald Jr., in addition to negotiating deals. Trump's five-day visit to Scotland is built around golf and promoting properties bearing his name. A small group of demonstrators at the course waved American flags and raised a sign criticizing British Prime Minister Keir Starmer, who plans his own Turnberry meeting with Trump on Monday. Other voices could be heard cheering and chanting Trump, Trump as he played nearby. On Tuesday, Trump will be in Aberdeen in northeastern Scotland, where his family has another golf course and is opening a third next month. The president and his sons plan to help cut the ribbon on the new course. The U.S. and EU seemed close to a deal earlier this month, but Trump instead threatened the 30% tariff rate. The deadline for the Trump administration to begin imposing tariffs has shifted in recent weeks, but is now firm, and coming Friday, the administration insists. No extensions, no more grace periods. August 1st, the tariffs are set. They'll go into place. Customs will start collecting the money and off we go, U.S. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick told Fox News Sunday before the EU deal was announced. He added, however, that even after the people can still talk to President Trump, I mean, he's always willing to listen. Without an agreement, the EU said it was prepared to retaliate with tariffs on hundreds of American products ranging from beef and auto parts to beer and Boeing airplanes. If Trump eventually followed through on his threat of tariffs against Europe, meanwhile, it could have made everything from French cheese and Italian leather goods to German electronics and Spanish pharmaceuticals more expensive in the United States. I think it's great that we made a deal today instead of playing games and maybe not making a deal at all, Trump said. I think it's the biggest deal ever made. The title of the next front page article is Data May Triple Arizona Power Demand. This article was written by Sasha Hupka of the Arizona Republic. The state's largest utility could see energy demand nearly triple if every data center they want to set up shop in their service areas comes to fruition, according to new filings. The Arizona Public Service Company and Salt River Project are already seeing massive, unprecedented load growth, and dozens more data center projects are still waiting in their electric service pipelines. Those facilities house the physical equipment needed to power computing, and the utilities told state regulators that they are clamoring for immense demand. Both utilities saw customers break energy demand records earlier this month amid soaring temperatures in Phoenix. APS reported an all-time high of 8,527 megawatts as daily temperatures hit 118 degrees at Sky Harbor International Airport, the hottest day of the summer so far. SRP delivered 8,324 megawatts of energy. That's small potatoes compared to the utility's assessments of future energy needs. APS, which serves 1.4 million people statewide, is being asked to provide an additional 17,000 megawatts of energy to fulfill data centers' needs. SRP, which currently lists 1.1 million customers, estimates it would need 12,000 megawatts of new power. Those individual totals are enough power for each electric provider to serve about 2.7 million average homes simultaneously. The numbers show the implications of Arizona's ongoing data center boom. Such facilities have flocked to the state for its competitive operating costs, low natural disaster risk, and strong fiber infrastructure, among other advantages. Meanwhile, the rise of artificial intelligence and other advanced technologies is driving demand for the server, network, and storage services that data centers provide. But so far, the state's largest utilities have committed to serving only a small fraction of the prospective data centers interested in moving to the valley. The computing equipment inside such facilities requires vast amounts of power. It also generates significant heat, which necessitates robust cooling systems. Those can use water or electricity like an air conditioning unit. Plus, data centers run continuously all day, every day. Those factors add up to a whole lot of power and make data centers different from other large customers served by utilities. Rachel Leonard, manager of state regulatory strategy at APS, told the Arizona Corporation Commission, that the facilities required tailored solutions and are of growing concern to the state. Data center customers are driving the need to procure new generation resources specifically to serve them, she said, adding that the trend means existing customers could end up footing the bill for new infrastructure under current rate designs. Others have echoed those concerns. A massive data center campus planned in Pima County has drawn ire from local residents who say the project will drain the area's water and energy resources. Some have linked the proposal to price hikes sought by Tucson Electric Power Company, even though the utility has publicly said that the vast facility didn't influence the rate review. Aaron Tingem of the Data Center Coalition, a trade organization for such facilities, said operators are willing to pay their fair share, but he questioned whether rate designs need to change to ensure residential customers are protected, and said any additional requirements on data centers should come with better service from the utilities. If additional requirements are placed on large customers in order to receive access to power, utility companies should have corresponding obligations, including meeting power delivery timelines. Tingem told utility regulators, adding that data centers bring economic opportunity to local communities and have made significant strides in sustainability over recent years. The recent filings come as part of an effort by state utility regulators to explore potential issues related to data centers. Corporation Commission Chair Kevin Thompson said the discussion could lead to the possible creation of more transparent rates for data center customers and the public. He encouraged utilities, data center operators, and other stakeholders to pitch solutions and ideas. APS said it is working to evaluate its policies to ensure that costs associated with new infrastructures are appropriately recovered from the customers that it serves. Leonard said the utility has developed new contract provisions for data centers customers to implement strict financial protection terms, minimum bill requirements, load ramp projections, and other measures intended to mitigate risk of potential cost shifts. The utility is also pitching a pricing design revamp in its ongoing rate case. It seeks to create a new category for data centers and other extremely large energy users. It would impose energy minimums, meaning certain large customers would be charged for a minimum amount of power that they commit to using monthly regardless of how much they actually use. SRP pointed to similar steps. It instituted minimum billing requirements for data centers at its most recent rate-setting process. Unlike APS, it doesn't set rates through the Corporation Commission, but its own elected board. It also requires large customers to be served with dedicated substations and to prepay for any infrastructure upgrades associated with bringing their load onto the grid. David Felix, senior manager of regulatory affairs for SRP, said a letter submitted to state regulators that utilities officials are studying other ways to create a more scalable and efficient process for new large loads and mitigate potential risks associated with those customers. The next front page article is titled, Officers Increasingly Don Face Masks. This article was written by Deepte Hajela of the Associated Press, Dateline, New York. In a matter of months, it became a regular sight around the country, immigration enforcement agents detaining people and taking them into custody, often as public anger and outcry unfolds around them. But something disappeared. The agents' faces covered by caps, sunglasses, pulled-up neck gaiters, or balaclavas, effectively rendering them unidentifiable. With the year only half over, the covered faces, as deployed by law enforcement in a wave of immigration crackdown directed by President Donald Trump's White House, became one of the most potent and contentious visuals of 2025. If Trump administration officials consistently defended the practice, saying immigration agents face increasing harassment in public and online as they went about their enforcement and service of Trump's drive toward mass deportation, and hiding their identities is for their and their family's safety to avoid things like death threats and doxing, where someone's personal information is released without their permission on the internet. I'm sorry if people are offended by them wearing masks, but I'm not going to let my officers and agents go out there and put their lives on the line, their families on the line, because people don't like what immigration enforcement is. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Acting Director Todd Lyons said last month. Democrats and others, including the several state attorneys general, pushed back, saying the use of face masks generates public fear and should be halted. In a recent letter to Lyons, a group of Democratic senators said the stepped-up immigration enforcement in workplaces, restaurants, and other sites caused dismay, and the increasingly common sight of masked agents represents a clear attempt to compound that fear and chaos and to avoid accountability for agents' actions. In American culture, covering one's face often went hand-in-hand with assumptions of negative behavior. Think bandits donning bandanas in cowboy movies or robbers putting on ski masks before pulling a heist on the bank. Even comic book superheroes who cover their faces are swept up in storylines in recent years that derisively refer to them as masks and say their decision to hide their identities while enforcing justice is transgressive. Americans saw mass police or paramilitary forces in other countries as antithetical to promised democracy and justice for all, and to the common law practice of being able to face your accusers. Mask wearing overall in American life took another hit during the COVID-19 pandemic, when many Trump supporters scoffed at notions that protective masks would insulate people from the deadly virus and scorned people who wore them. Most recently, Trump came out against masks, at least when they're being worn by protesters. He posted on social media that demonstrators wearing masks should be arrested. Given all that cultural context, it's even more problematic that those enforcing laws have their facing covered, said Tobias Winwright, professor of moral theology at St. Patrick's Pontifical University in Maynooth, Ireland. He has worked in law enforcement in the U.S. and writes frequently about policing ethics. If what you're doing is above board and right, he said, then why conceal your identity? For those who question why it's different for law enforcement to wear masks, if protesters and non-law enforcement personnel are doing it, it's because symbols have different meanings based on the power and position of the people using them, said Allison Kinney, author of Hood, a book about that clothing item and the ways people used it. ICE agents are agents of the state, she said, and they're invested with not only power, but also with protections and carrying out their jobs. But that job is also supposed to be public service. It's also supposed to be accountable and responsible to the public. And so they have a greater responsibility for transparency and accountability and making themselves known so that we can hold them accountable for the justice or injustice of their actions, she said. Concerns over how law enforcement is held accountable to the public have come up before. Advocates pushed for officers to wear body cameras and demanded that police officers have visible names and badge numbers. However, there wasn't much discussion around police masking because there isn't a widespread history of it in the U.S. outside of SWAT or undercover-type operations, Winwright said. The most high-profile example of mask-wearing in American history is for the purpose of hiding identity is also the most negative one. Racist attacks carried out by the members of the Ku Klux Klan. The masks served the purpose, of course, of keeping the wearer's identity secret, said Elaine Frunz, a history professor at Kent State University and author of Ku Klux, The Birth of Klan During Reconstruction. But they also made it easier for those wearing them to commit violent acts against others, she said. One thing about a mask is it kind of works like being behind a riot shield, Frunz said. When you have more separation from the person you're attacking, it's easier to dehumanize that person. Winwright said he hoped law enforcement mask wearing doesn't become normalized. There was at least one expansion into local policing. In New York, Nassau County's executive Bruce Blakeman signed an executive order allowing police officers to wear masks during certain types of work, including working with immigration agents. Winwright is concerned the move could strain police-community relations even more, putting officers even more at even more risk. Wearing a mask seems to increase fear and decrease trust, he said. And policing from federal to local in America needs trust and transparency, and community relations are positive. The harm, the risks are greater by wearing masks, not only to the individual officers, but to the profession itself, as well as to the United States society, he added. It's just going to further exacerbate the us versus them polarization, the lack of trust, and that's the probably last thing we need right now. The next article from the front page of the Arizona Daily Star is titled, "She Was Trying to Seduce Him." This article is about financial scams of the elderly rising, AG Pima Council on Aging Warn. This article was written by Sierra Blazer of the Arizona Daily Star. Tucsonan David Wright drained his wife Mary's $250,000 retirement account, sending tens of thousands of dollars to a woman he met on Facebook last year. The couple in their 70s took out a loan on a Jeep which had already been repossessed once for missing payments. They are also hoping they can take out a home equity loan. The couple's example is one of the most extreme reported to the Pima County, or rather the Pima Council on Aging, which offers resources to older adults daily who have been scammed via social media, emails, or phone calls. From fake social media relationships to AI media cloning, financial scams targeting older adults are at an all-time high. And Arizona has the highest rate, the attorney general says. David, 74, built an online relationship with Catherine Charlotte over the course of a couple of months, typically chatting about her work and their daily lives. She is pictured in a photo she sent him as a blonde, hazel-eyed woman looking to be in her late 30s. After 2 months of talking online, the woman who claimed to be a chef from the East Coast said she needed to send the company $30,000 to get a job as a chef on an oil rig in Mexico, David said. He sent her the money to try to help her out, he said. All of the funds he sent were from his wife's 401k. He is not a thief, but he can take chivalry and heroic generosity too far, said Mary, 75. If I'd have known what he was doing, I would have said, oh no, you don't. David said after he sent the first payment, Charlotte would request money for clothing costs or food, claiming her new job wasn't paying her on time or fairly. She was supposedly going to get $750,000 for working on a platform. I found out what chefs on platforms make. It's about $50,000 to $60,000 a year, Mary said. She was trying to seduce him. Charlotte's contract on the platform was up in August, David said. But when she tried to come back to the United States, the Mexican Tax Administration, which is legitimate, I checked out, had assessed her at $50,000. David said he was dubious about sending her the money and even tried to speak with the Mexican consulate himself, but was unsuccessful. So he did as she requested and put $50,000 into her American bank account. It occurred to me at the time, why am I putting it in an American bank if she doesn't have access to her funds, David said. Mary said she found out about her husband's online friend last fall after he asked if they could lend her $11,000, claiming she would pay them back. I said, I'm not giving her $11,000, Mary said, but he had been giving her money before then that I didn't know about. So he had to fess up, and even after I told him, you're not doing this anymore, he kept sending her money from the Vanguard account. The couple was receiving a monthly $500 payment out of the retirement account until it ran dry. The money dwindled early this year, the couple said, and Charlotte stopped messaging David shortly after he told her he couldn't send her any more money. I wanted to help her out, David said. Cases of elder fraud are on the rise across the country, and Arizona has the highest rate at 289 cases per 100,000 seniors due to the aging population, according to Arizona Attorney General Chris Mayes. I think the rise and prevalence of technology is only making it worse in a lot of ways, Mayes said. She said her office is currently running a campaign to attend town halls across the state educating communities on the newest scams affecting Arizonans. I think the best way to stop a scam is to know what it looks like, Mays said. In southern Arizona, the Pima County's department receives reports of financial scams daily, said fraud detective Michael Wilson. Most of them affect the elderly. They are a huge population in Pima County, Wilson said. They're targets for scammers because they usually have a lot of assets and they have a lot of susceptibility when it comes to trusting other folks. Wilson said some of the most common types of fraud include romance scams, government impersonations, and AI cloning. Romance scams usually build up trust over the course of months and sometimes years before the scammers ask for sums of money, Wilson said. Folks in Pima County are often snowbirds, so they're far away from family members, often living in isolation, sometimes widowed, he said. They're usually seeking some companionship or just somebody to talk to on a regular basis. With that type of emotional state, we see scammers exploit them. It's not uncommon for people to give money to those they care about as gifts or aid, he said, but oftentimes once the money is gone, the victim gets blocked. The second most common type of fraud is government impersonation. That can cover impersonations by the IRS for taxes or Social Security as well as law enforcement agencies, Wilson said. The thing that all these have in common is that the elderly often have a high level of respect for those groups, but they're also entitled entities that seem hard to verify information with. Wilson said AI voice and face cloning have also become prevalent in the last year. Scammers will pretend to be a romantic partner through videos or sound like a family member over the phone who's claiming to have been kidnapped or arrested. I just had a situation a couple of weeks back in the Green Valley area where a gentleman had a romantic interest online, the detective said. He sent this person an undisclosed amount of money over time, and while he chose not to pursue an investigation, he did provide video of this woman speaking to him. To the man, the woman looked like she was holding a conversation, but the fraud unit found multiple signs of video manipulation. We were actually trying to locate the original source of that video on social media, and when we compared the two, you could see where the manipulations were made, Wilson said. Occurrences of that are increasing by the day at this point. Last year, the Pima County Sheriff's Department recovered $1.4 million for county residents, though it's not always a guarantee that money can be found. Wilson said the sooner victims report the loss and potential scam, the better chances are for financial recovery. The length of time is what makes these investigations so difficult, Wilson said. Scammers will usually move funds through different mediums, including Bitcoin, gift cards, checks, and cash, sometimes to other countries. The best ability we have to actually make a difference for victims is to decrease the response time. The most common areas that see elderly victims of financial scams are in Green Valley and Catalina Foothill areas, but people of all ages can fall victims, said Fernando Flores, a Tucson community manager at Chase Bank. He said business owners are often a big target as well because they're always on the go. Business never sleeps, and some of these people work 7 days a week, Flores said. So if a phone call comes in saying they need to pay the internet bill and give their information to resolve the issue, sometimes they'll do it without taking a step back because they need to get to the next thing. Flores advised that before sending money or giving any personal information out over the phone or through email, everyone take a step back and look for anything suspicious. If it's something critically urgent, it's one of those urgency hook lines. That's a key indicator it's a scam, Flores said. Those could include claims of fraud on a bank account, a warrant for arrest, or an unpaid bill. Every literal minute that goes by, it gets harder for us to get money back, Flores said. We'll do our best to try and help, but depending on the vessel they use to send it through, it may be gone. David and Mary Wright have had to take out a title loan on their Jeep, which has already been repossessed once, and are struggling to get an equity loan on their income. Since January this year, my wife and I have been in a distressed financial situation, he said. David is, however, back in contact on WhatsApp with Catherine, who continues to demand money according to screenshots he sent the Star after an interview. Ray Vermeil, Pima County on Aging Rights and Benefits Supervisor, explained that in many cases, victims still believe the scammer is the person they claim to be. They still think it's real, and that's just the horrible part of it, Vermeil said. While Pima Council on Aging advocates for older adults and provides resources to help them make informed choices, Adult Protective Services is the organization that investigates exploitation of vulnerable adults. The couple said they didn't report the scam to authorities because they believed it was out of their jurisdiction. David and Mary are currently attending couples counseling and seeking resources from Pima County on Aging to try to make sure their home doesn't get repossessed. Now we'll pause the broadcast reading for a reminder that you are listening to a broadcast reading of the Arizona Daily Star from Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Michael Shannon, and I'm a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org, from the broadcast info and audio link. Sun Sounds is also available on your smart home device. We'll now continue with the next article from the Tucson and Region section of the Arizona Daily Star. The first article from that section is titled, Russia's Warplanes Use U.S.-Made Electronics. This article was written by Derry Lenahan of the Cronkite News, Dateline Washington. Russia continues to obtain U.S.-made microelectronics despite strict export controls. Those ships, including some from manufacturers with Arizona facilities, end up in advanced fighter jets used against Ukraine and linked with alleged war crimes. That's according to a recent report from the Independent Anti-Corruption Commission, the International Partnership for Human Rights, and Hunter Brook Media. The report found that components made by U.S. industry giants such as Analog Devices, Texas Instruments, and Intel have been found in the cockpits and avionics bays of Su-34 and Su-35 fighters, the workhorses of Moscow's precision bombing campaigns in Ukraine. The report looked at 60 airstrikes on civilian infrastructure from May 2023 to May 2024 and analyzed over 180,000 customs shipment records. Based in part on studying downed Russian jets, the researchers found 1,119 microelectronic components made by 141 different Western companies. Nearly all were made in the U.S., 68% of those found in Su-34s, and 62% of those found in Su-35s. The vast majority of those companies are based in the United States, and many have operations in Arizona. Many of the Western components found in Russian warplanes are classified as high priority by the Department of Commerce Bureau of Industry and Security. Such items are banned for sale to Russia and are subject to strict export regulations. Two-thirds of the Western-made components found in the Su-34s fall in that category, including field programmable gate arrays, or FPGAs, made by Intel and specialized integrated circuits made by Analog Devices. While all of the components should be off-limits to Russia, 6% are regarded by the BIS to especially sensitive to U.S. national security. The investigation does not allege any wrongdoing by the manufacturers, but it does highlight how ineffective current sanctions and export controls have been stanching the flow of microelectronics critical to the Russian war machine. Governments must implement harsher sanctions against Russia, and manufacturers must introduce higher due diligence and supply chain control standards to prevent their product diversions into Russian weapons, wrote Anastasia Donets, lead of the Ukraine legal team in IPHR. In a statement to Cronkite News, NXP, which makes ceramic capacitors and microprocessors found in the fighter jets, operates two manufacturing facilities in Chandler. The company denied any wrongdoing and said it is committed to ensuring its products do not end up in the hands of U.S. adversaries. NXP does not tolerate the sale, export, or re-export directly or indirectly of NXP products to the Russian Federation, North Korea, Iran, Belarus, or the use of NXP products in those countries, the company told Cronkite News in a written statement. Additionally, NXP has not been found to have violated any export control or sanction laws. memory chips produced by AMD, some of which are fabricated in Phoenix at the huge Taiwan semiconductor manufacturing company plant, were also found in Russian warplanes. TSMC declined to comment on the finding. Last September, representatives from AMD, Intel, Texas Instruments, and Analog Devices testified before a Senate investigative subcommittee. We found companies' efforts to track the path of their chips into Russia to be slow, unhelpful, or non-existent, Senator Richard Blumenthal, Democrat of Connecticut, who chaired the panel at the time, said at the hearing, titled The U.S. Company's Technology Fueling the Russian War Machine. The panel's investigators found that the companies exercised too little oversights over their distributors, he said, adding that our investigation shows that the excuses offered by companies to explain the presence of their products in Russia ring hollow. 10 months later, he remains dissatisfied with the efforts by the tech companies and law enforcement. Safeguards have to be strengthened, and most importantly, they have to be enforced, Blumenthal said in an interview at the Capitol last week. The subcommittee's current chair, Senator Ron Johnson, Republican of Wisconsin, was somewhat less troubled by the report. I don't view it as particularly sinister. I just view it as hard to track all these parts, he told Cronkite News. You can't control everything. If you try to control everything, people completely lose freedom. Senator Mark Kelly, Democrat of Arizona, acknowledged that controlling where U.S. components end up is extremely hard. It is a problem that we're aware of, and we are trying to deal with it. It's not easy, though. I mean, you can take a circuit board out of a washing machine and put it in a missile, he told Cronkite News. At the September hearing, the four companies in the spotlight pledged to strengthen their compliance efforts, but said it's a big challenge. Once their chips and other components are sold legally into the global market, they can change hands multiple times, making them almost impossible to trace. Russia has managed to circumvent sanctions and export controls in part by using sophisticated supply chain networks with help from China, according to the recent report. 10% of this problem is about Western chip firms' compliance efforts, which I think are insufficient. But 90% is about Beijing's active support of Russia's war effort, said Chris Miller, a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and author of the book Chip War, The Fight for the World's Most Critical Technology. Miller agreed that it's difficult for tech companies to track, let alone control, what their Chinese customers do with their purchases. U.S. chips purportedly bought for civilian purposes can be repurposed by the Russian military. We should put more pressure on China to stop aiding Russia's military, Miller said. Beijing is Russia's most important technology partner and is actively supporting the development of Russian military power. President Donald Trump recently gave Moscow a 50-day deadline to reach a peace deal with Kiev, threatening secondary actions on China, India, and other countries that buy its oil, natural gas, and other products. Such sanctions will be far more impactful on the Russian economy than the direct sanctions in place for the last 3 years. All but 17 senators have co-sponsored a bill to impose a 500% tariff on countries that buy Russian oil, uranium, and other exports. Kelly and fellow Arizona Democrat Ruben Galeo backed the measure. In 2024, China imported 2.2 million barrels of Russian crude oil per day, worth over $62 billion for the year, according to United Nations trade data. We should give Ukraine what it needs to defend itself and in time, with the right assistance combined with the sanctions, tariffs, and secondary sanctions, we could put Russia in a situation where this is an untenable thing for them going forward, Kelly said. The next item is titled, Picture Rocks Man Given 15 Years for Son's Death. This article was written by Erica Wurst of the Arizona Daily Star. A Picture Rocks man was sentenced Friday to a maximum of 15 years in prison for crimes related to the 2024 death of his 9-year-old son. Joseph Gregory Antonsen, who pleaded guilty to 2 counts of child abuse, was also sentenced to 20 years of probation after his release. Authorities said Anson left the home he shared with his son for 2 days, despite witnessing the boy shuddering and going limp, and then being unable to find a pulse on the child, the court document says. He would not tell investigators where he went. Deputies found the boy's body on a couch inside the home, the Pima County Sheriff's Department said in a news release. The boy was in a sitting position and appeared to have been dead long enough for decomposition to begin, the court document says. Antonson told investigators his son was ill about 2 days, and then he had planned to take him to get medical attention, according to an interim complaint filed in Pima County Justice Court. He told investigators he started the car to take the boy to medical treatment, but when he went back into the house, he put on a shirt. He noticed his son going limp, the complaint said. At that point, he said, the child wasn't breathing, and he was unable to find a pulse. Deputies described the home at the 6,000 block of North Telto Path near West Picture Rocks and North San Dario Roads as cluttered with piles of garbage around and near the couch. The home had no running water or working toilets. The home was filled with lots of empty beer cans, large piles of soiled diapers, rotten food, large amounts of 1 gallon bottles full of what appeared to be urine, the court filing said. The next article is titled, Tucson's Iron Chef Again. This article was written by Catalina E. Birch of the Arizona Daily Star. Oban Sushi Bar Ramen Executive Chef Anthony Drumgul held onto his title as Iron Chef Tucson on Saturday, defeating challenger Mackenzie O'Leary at the Andouille Sausage Battle at Desert Diamond Casino. No official score was released Saturday night, but Drumgul said he was surprised he won. "We let the time get away from us this time," he said, adding that he expected he'd also get dinged after a hiccup in plating one of his dishes. O'Leary, executive chef at Danque Verde Ranch and only the second woman to compete in the contest 17 years, embraced her teenage daughter after the competition. "We did it," she said. Later, she said she was pleased with her team's performance, but was frustrated by comments from the judges reminding her and Drumgul about the time, saying it was a distraction. In comments from the judges' table, Chef Maria Mazan, who has competed in the nationally televised Bravo reality show Top Chef, sounded the alarm. 35 minutes into the competition, warning the chefs they should allow themselves 15 minutes to plate the dishes. At the 10-minute mark, both chefs had started plating their 4 dishes, including O'Leary's final one, a sweet and savory fritter topped with a warm honey and andouille sausage compote that earned the judges' praise. "This is our best dish of the night," gushed Mazan, chef owner of Boca by Chef Maria Mazan. The two other judges were Jan Osipiewicz, executive chef of Desert Diamond Casino, and Tucson foodie editor Jackie Tran, former chef owner of Trans Fats food truck. Drumgul's andouille hash with sweet potatoes and slow roasted pork chop sided with a pour-over broth earned a high praise from Judge Osipiewicz. "The flavor profile, the broth on the side, it's my favorite dish so far," Osipiewicz said. Drumgul's win earned him $500 gifts from Arizona Restaurant Supply, an engraved cutting board on display at Oban, radio commercials from Iron Chef Tucson organizer Lotus Communications, and a Peroni pizza oven. O'Leary and Drumgul's andouille battle played out before a crowd of several hundred at Desert Diamond Casino Kitchen Stadium and capped a day of cooking demonstrations and sampling. Guests could nibble their way to a full stomach from the deconstructed tamales, Southwest-themed pierogies with spicy tomatillo sauce, and handmade desserts from the casino's chefs to the spicy and creamy Southwest Creole chicken pasta created by Arizona Appliance and Home Chef Gabriel McCarter. Whiskey Del Back was serving a chicken dish made with its whiskey to complement samples of its classic Dorado Seminole Rye, and recently released Distiller's Cut whiskies. A few tables over, EG's set out cups of its icy Sonora Sunset flavor of the month. Drumgul is the fourth chef to win back-to-back titles. He said he hopes to return next year to try for a three-peat, something that only Chef Ryan Clark has achieved. Clark, who emceed Saturday's competition with Charles Steak executive chef Gary Hickey, won back-to-back Iron Chef Tucson competitions from 2011 to 2013. The next article is titled, Merch Doesn't Mean Votes. This article was written by Howard Fisher of Capital Media Services. Sure, it's nice to buy a cap, a t-shirt, or a coffee mug with the name of your favorite candidate. But new research suggests if you're then far less likely to turn out on election day to help a candidate than if you had donated the same amount of money. Those who participate in high visibility support by purchasing campaign swag are also less likely to volunteer to help that candidate's campaign than those who give small amounts of money, according to Anastasia Ghosh, a marketing professor at the University of Arizona who headed the research team. Ghosh said her research gives her a pretty good idea why. People who do things that are visible to others versus what feels like an anonymous donation seem to believe they've done their bit for the cause. And at that point, she said, they are less likely to follow through with the less visible things like volunteering, and in this case, voting. Me, buying something and carrying it around, using it in my household, others observing me, it seems to me that I have done more for the candidates, she explained, of the attitude of those who flaunt campaign items. But Ghosh said there's a certain irony in that, given her research findings. That provides a crucial lesson for those running candidates' campaigns who think that selling buttons and bumper stickers is going to translate into victory on election day, she told Capital Media Services. If I'm a campaign manager, you buy a t-shirt from me, is a lot less lucrative for me, if you will, than you giving me that money right away, she said. I have to create a t-shirt, I have to ship it to you, and the money that's left over is really small, but me, as a consumer, I feel I've done more for you. Her study also found it matters whether others will notice the item. One experiment cited is where people were asked to wear a candidate t-shirt. Some were told they would be wearing it in a nearly empty grocery store. Others were told they would be in a more crowded spot. The effect was much stronger when other people were around, Garth said, with those who were more visible less likely to then do other things such as convince undecided voters. That ties to her conclusion that visibility matters. It's called impression management, which includes a desire to be seen. If I have made my donation to a candidate, in most cases nobody knows about it, Ghosh said. If I spend an equivalent amount of money to put a t-shirt on myself with the name of the candidate, I understand that other people will see. If I'm surrounded by people who are similar to me, that's probably a positive impression. Still, she said, there may be times when the more visible signs of support, like the t-shirt and the yard signs, are more valuable to the candidate, even if the people buying the items or erecting the signs ultimately don't turn out at the polls. If you're starting out on a campaign, your goal is to signal to the world or your constituents that you have a very popular candidate, Garth said. Maybe it's worth investing into asking for merchandise that will be publicly worn. Maybe the person who bought it is not going to be a voter, but maybe others who will observe it will. But that effect only goes so far. As you move along the election cycle, you really need commitment from people to show up and vote, she said. And then it's when you need to move into direct donations. Put in another way, Ghosh said, a candidate may have to tell someone that it's great that someone put out a yard sign, but I need you to show up. She even has given a name to all this, political selectivism, a term Ghosh said was suggested by one of her students. Those buying or displaying merchandise or signs are demonstrating that they're engaged in the election and supporting the candidate, but they're not going to do the hard thing, which is actually showing up to vote. It isn't just about voting, Ghosh said. She found the same effect about volunteering. People who purchase candidate campaign items are less likely to be the ones to volunteer their time, make phone calls, and go door to door to drop off campaign materials, she said. All of this is based on multiple sources of information, she said. There is some historical data in which people were asked whether they had yard signs and bumper stickers and whether, in the end, they voted. That was considered to ensure that any new findings were not aberrations, she said. Second were surveys during the 2020 national election of people who declared themselves to be supporters of one party or the other. Monitoring started during the national conventions and ran through November. What that showed, she said, is that those who bought political swag were 91% less likely to go to the polls than those who made financial donations. Finally, there were studies done with students. In one case, some students were told they made a small donation in the form of buying a $5 political button when they were given the button and told to wear it. Other students were simply told that a $5 donation was made on their behalf. In both cases, students were asked how many text messages they would be willing to send out on behalf of the party and how many calls they would make for the party. Gosch found that those who got the merchandise were less likely to have further engagement with their political party than those who were told they had given money. Now we'll head directly to the business section of the Arizona Daily Star for an interesting article there titled Finances, an Analysis of the First Family. President and his relatives are enriched by leveraging status in Washington. This article was written by Brian Stodowski and Will Weiser of the Associated Press. From crypto coins to Bibles, overseas development deals to an upcoming line of cell phones, President Donald Trump's family businesses raked in hundreds of millions of dollars since his election. That flood of money from billionaires, foreign governments, and cryptocurrency tycoons permitted the president to leverage the power of his office for personal gain. Trump made money during his first term by turning his hotels and resort properties into destinations for his MAGA allies and those who sought to curry favor with him. This time around, the family's ambitions are grander. One of Trump's cryptocurrencies is estimated to have pulled in at least $320 million since January, while another received a $2 billion investment from a foreign government's wealth fund. The third sold at least $550 million in tokens. His sons jetted it across the Middle East to line up new development deals, while his daughter and son-in-law are working on with the Albanian government to build a Mediterranean island resort. First Lady Melania Trump inked a $40 million documentary deal with Amazon, whose founder Jeff Bezos contracts extensively with the federal government. He also touted the line of Trump shoes, a Bible made in China, and Trump guitars, one of which sells for $1,500. He continues to make money from political spending at his hotels, resorts, and golf courses. Conservative groups and Republican committees spent at least $25 million at Trump properties since 2015, most of it from Trump's own political organization, Trump Finances Disclosures Show. Since Richard Nixon resigned in disgrace, presidents went to great length to avoid the appearance of such conflicts. Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan kept assets in a blind trust, while George H.W. Bush used a diversified trust, which blocked him from knowing what was in his portfolio. His son, George W. Bush, used a similar arrangement. Barack Obama was an exception, but his investments were mostly a bland mix of index funds and U.S. treasuries. During his first term, Trump issued a moratorium on foreign deals. But instead of placing his assets in a blind trust like many of his predecessors, he handed the reins of the Trump Organization to his children, which kept his financial holdings close. This time, his sons, Eric and Don Jr., are again running the business, but there is no moratorium on foreign deals. Though the White House says Trump is not involved in its day-to-day decisions, the trust he established continues to profit. Business Ventures Trump holds an interest and launched three different crypto coins that collectively pulled in billions of dollars in investment and revenue. Trump and his family have majority ownership stake in World Liberty Financial that entitles them to 75% earnings from their first coin, the $WLFI, released in September, according to the company's website. Justin Sun, a Chinese-born crypto billionaire, purchased $30 million worth of those tokens, which helped the company clear an early capitalization target. He since disclosed investing at least $60 million more into Trump's various cryptocurrencies. In February, the Trump administration paused a securities fraud case against him. Days before his inauguration, Trump announced another cryptocurrency, a meme coin called $Trump. Often created as a joke, meme coins are prone to wild price swings that often enrich a small group of insiders at the expense of less sophisticated investors. That token soared to $70, but its price soon collapsed, losing money for many. Trump did well, though. By the end of April, the coin earned $320 million in fees for its creators, according to an analysis of the crypto tracking firm Chainalysis. A third cryptocurrency, a stable coin called USD1, launched in April. It drew $2 billion investment from a fund controlled by the United Arab Emirates government. The Trumps can invest that money and keep the interest it earns, estimated to be worth about $80 million a year. Soon after, Trump granted the UAE greater access to U.S. artificial intelligence chips, which it long sought. Trump recently was asked at the White House about the conflicts of interest that his family's crypto holdings present. He largely sidestepped the question. "We've created a very powerful industry that's much more important than anything that we invest in," the president said. "I don't care about investing, you know. I have kids, and they invest in it because they do believe in it." He added, "But I'm president, and what I did there was build an industry that's very important, and if we didn't have it, China would." Harrison Fields, the White House spokesman, reiterated that Trump's crypto boosterism isn't driven by self-interest. Due to time constraints, we have reached the end of today's reading of the Arizona Daily Star, the Monday, July 28th, 2025 edition. For Sun Sounds of Arizona, this is Michael Shannon, your volunteer reader. Thank you very much for listening.